So we're going to do Jim's choice first. It is Electricity. And let's play a little bit of it, and then we'll all talk about it.
The Minas is loveless. He talks to the land, and the leaves fall, and the pond overrises. She don't know the system, plus she don't understand. She's got all her own fuses and splices. She's not going to fix it up. Too easy. The masking tape tangles, it's sticky and black, and the copper proud-headed Queen Lizzie conducts little charges that don't get charged back. Well, the technical manual's busy. She's not gonna fix it all too easy. And she holds out.
As I'm listening to this, I'm realizing it is a song that a guy who spends a lot of time in recording studios might pick. But tell us why you did pick it.
Well, for me, it's off of the unsung masterpiece For the Roses, which was sandwiched in between two other masterpieces, Blue and Court and Spark. Mm-hmm. And so it probably didn't get the attention that it deserved in my book. I don't think it's ever gotten that attention. It had her first top 40 hit prior to this, You Turned Me On to My Radio. But it also, I thought this song was cool in a whole bunch of ways. In high school, it was sort of wallpaper for me. And lyrically, in the hands of a lesser artist, this could have been really clumsy. And that sort of metaphor throughout. And also, at the very end of this song, she goes into this layered vocal thing that she does from time to time that, to me, translates directly into, oh, what did Prince like about her? Well, he liked a lot of stuff about her, but I think that particular style of production that she was flirting with, starting with Ladies in the Canyon, but really a lot during Blue and For the Roses, the layered vocals, was a breakthrough for her, and I think it influenced a ton of people, including Prince. Hmm.
Mika, what does this song say to you?
Well, I mean, I know this sounds horribly pretentious or something, but, you know, I do think of Joni's career as sort of dividing into three parts. And the first part is her folk persona, of which I would say this album and this song represents, in a way, the pinnacle of. And then later on comes the sort of jazzy avant-garde anything goes period, and then there's the third period, which I don't even know that well, of her kind of mature, angst-ridden, middle-aged stuff. But you know, among other things, you're reminded about just the voice and the coolness of that first period of voice. I mean, before cigarettes and whatever she was doing started to take their toll. But, I mean, it really is. I mean, among all those kind of 60s folky people, I mean, it really is a crystalline, lovely voice. And you're kind of reminded of that more than anything.
You know, as we so often wind up saying with her, I mean, the same guy who was telling her that he needed a radio hit out of her, he didn't get her to structure the song in any particularly recognizable songwriting way, right?
The song
is just like things happen musically because she wants them to.
Yep. And she's using one of her many
tunings,
like what, 50 tunings, 30 tunings? I'm not sure. And just moving her hand around to hear something that she thinks sounds great. And she always finds it.
So maybe that's a good transition to, we're going to move ahead a few years. I think 76, so 75, I was going to say 76. So to Hissing of Summer Lawns, and this is Steve Metcalf's choice, Edith and the Kingpin.
Small town, big man.
So Metcalf, help orient us.
Okay, so this is 1975, and I think I chose this song mostly because I was consciously trying to remember when these albums unfolded one by one, which was the one that said, wow, this woman has taken a turn to something really, really interesting, and she is certainly no longer just a folk singer, and she is obviously announcing herself as a really major talent, both lyrically and musically. And for me, it was this album, Hissing, which was not, by the way, a particularly well-received album, it didn't sell that well, and I don't even think it was critically, as they say, received all that well, but I think it's mostly brilliant. And of course, this song is before Jaco Pastorius mm-hmm. started working with her, and yet it still takes a very definite turn in the jazz direction in a way that I think caught a lot of people by surprise.
You know, Jim, I don't know if you have the same memory, but I know that we do all have the same kinds of memories. These are the days when you get a record album. And I remember there's something unforgiving gunmetal gray about the cover of this. I think it's gray and green. And I remember actually looking at it, and right away it's kind of, even before you take it out of its sleeve, there's something being said to you, like, this is not like any of the last few albums. And the minute you start playing it, you start thinking, I mean, obviously I am going to have to take the journey toward this music. This music is not taking a journey towards me.
I get the sense that this, you know, was a pivot out of Court and Spark, where she had all the hits after hits, and was working with these great musicians who she learned to trust. Because prior to this, she played a lot of the stuff herself and just had a few sidemen here and there. And she was playing with density, you know, with full instrumentation. And it's one of those sort of 70s perfectly crafted records, but it doesn't suffer from perfection.
Well, I think she didn't like the commercial sound, and this is where she has enough oomph to say,
right,
you know, I don't want to play with those kinds of musicians. I don't want the bass to sound like that. I don't want the drums to sound like that. I want it to all sound different. All right, we've been visiting with Steve Metcalf and Jim Chapdelaine. They will be back in May as we review the life and work of Soupy Sales.